Hi, everybody. I'm Jack Armstrong. I will be your host for this episode of Who's on Bainbridge, which is a podcast radio program that introduces you to local people who help make Bainbridge Island such a fascinating and engaging place to live. And with this particular broadcast, we are starting a series of interviews that we'll be doing in conjunction with the StoryShare Project, which is a collaborative effort among the Bainbridge Island Historical Museum, the Bainbridge Island Senior and Community Center, and Bainbridge Community Broadcasting, with a goal of telling the stories of Bainbridge Island, both to get an oral history perspective and also to hear personal insights from people who've been part of the island's history. And I am really honored to welcome Reed Hansen for this first program. I'm a relative newcomer to the island, and last year we took Reed's wonderful tour, which I guess he does several times a year, of Old Bainbridge, and he seems like the perfect person to join us. Reed, welcome.
Thank you.
This may be a rude thing to ask, but when were you born? And you were born here, right?
I was born 1929. That makes me 86 years old and enjoying good health.
Wonderful. What was it? Have you lived here all your life?
I was born here. I went to high school here. Then I was went to the University of Washington in 1947. Graduated in 1952. I was in the Marine Corps Reserve. Was taken overseas to Korea and then Japan. In the meantime, I was married. Came home to a 4-month-old baby boy, and started teaching school. And hadn't quit working since.
You taught here on the island?
Taught in Bellevue for 30 years.
Wow.
And enjoyed every minute of it, and retired 30 years ago.
So you grew up here and then were away for a while, but came back.
We actually came back to my grandfather purchased 10 acres over at Crystal Springs on 300 feet of waterfront for $200 in 1895. And it was divided into three parts when he passed away, and I still have a third of the property. Live in the same house I grew up in after we've traveled the United States, traveled Europe and Asia, and kind of settled down now to taking cruises.
Well, that's a good way to get around. One of the things that fascinated me most when I took that tour last year, and I would encourage any of you listening to check out through the Senior Center when Reed will be doing these, because it's well worth the time. But one of the things that fascinated me most was, as we'd go around in this van, you would talk about little individual kind of isolated communities that existed all around the island. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Yes. It's kind of started with the Port Blakely Mill when the mill closed in the 20s. And even before that, when people came to the island, they went to different areas of the island. For instance, my grandfather came to Crystal Springs from Norway. And the area where I live was kind of like he saw in Oslo, Norway, right on the water with a pier there and so forth. And there are mostly Norwegians, Swedes along that area. The actual Crystal Springs area was developed by a man named Jack Nibby, who was in the Civil War. He was a hero. Abraham Lincoln gave certain land to different heroes during Civil War. The area of Crystal Springs was given to Jack Nibby, and it was called Nibbyville when the early pioneers came there, and the land was purchased from them, including my grandfather. Other communities popped up along the way. For instance, Seabold was an area that was inhabited by a lot of Scandinavians also. The name came from Norwegian, supposedly, because the sea is bold, And that's how somehow that Siebold got his name. And Siebold had a little store. Going back to some of these original communities, the roads were so bad. People, if they had a car, only had one car. So they didn't have to get around too much, but it was difficult to get around. And remember when I was growing up, even as a high school student, you didn't go to the other end of the island unless you happened to have a girlfriend who lived there. And otherwise, you didn't go there. It was so difficult.
So what would be, say, the average population of one of these little villages, for lack of a better word?
Oh, maybe 300-400 people, possibly. At that time, they were pretty small. They weren't too spread out like they are today. For instance, there was another place called Manzanita. They had their own post office. They had a store run by a man named Orrin Sullivan, who was a friend of ours. And that was kind of a self-contained community. One thing about that, they had a pier, Manzanita Pier, and it was said that during Prohibition, that a lot of the booze to the island came in on the Manzanita Pier from Canada, and which may or may not be true, but that's a story that's been told. When the Lindbergh baby was kidnapped, quite a scare into the people who lived around that area in the east. And a people named Westinghouse came out and built a huge house overlooking Manzanita Bay, which is still there today. John Lindbergh, son of Charles Lindbergh, lived there for a while, and I'm not sure who lives there today. Linwood Center was built by a man named Emanuel Olson from England. They built an English-style Tudor store and theater and so forth in that area. And it's still there today. A lot of it's getting larger. Pleasant Beach grew up. They called it Sylvan Grove. And it was an area which was kind of a playground of the island. And the whole area, steamers used to land there from Seattle, from around Puget Sound. There was a post office. There was a big swimming pool. There was a hotel. There were ball fields. This kind of went away in the 20s when the mill closed.
So when you say a playground, was it?
Ball fields and so forth. They even had a gym where they had boxing matches.
And did people come from elsewhere in the island to go there, or is it mainly tourists from Seattle?
They came from the island. Like, for instance, my dad was a teenager at that time, and he'd go down there to play ball or to watch ball games. People came from Seattle, from Tacoma, from all over Puget Sound to the area.
Wow.
And it was quite a place. Winslow, of course, was one of the first areas that grew up. The Hoskinsons and the Groves were two early pioneers of the area. Today we have a Grow Avenue. And it might
and
say
a Grow
also,
community.
A Grow community, which is building by the, as we speak,
yeah,
almost. And I might say, too, a lot of the early roads on the island were named for pioneers. In 1972, they decided that they're going to change from the rural route box system to each house should have an address. In order for each house to have an address, they need to have a street. And so they started naming all these roads and streets and so forth.
So
and
some of them were not named before?
Not named before.
So if you were giving somebody directions to your house, what would you do?
You gave them directions, you would say, you follow that road down till it curves, and there's a blue house at the corner. You go right there, and then you continue on to the red house, and then you're almost there. That was the way you did it then. But now every house has a street number on a road, and a lot of the road names now are pretty contrived. You know, a realtor can open a piece of land and give the road a name.
Really? And, does the city need to approve the name, or is it just?
I'm not sure of that, if they have to approve it or not, but they do need a road. Otherwise, you can't get mail delivered, and you have to have a box. You have to have a house number.
Yeah,
and so that made it interesting.
How was mail delivered before there were addresses?
The mailman from the post office, for instance, Port Blakely Post Office, all it had to have on it was my dad's name and Port Blakely, and it would be delivered because they knew everybody. The guy who delivered the mail knew everybody. Today, unless you have the exact number on a letter, it's not going to get delivered.
Right.
So yeah, things were, everybody knew everybody. You know, it was different. Other places, Wing Point was developed. They had a huge golf, started a golf club there with a golf course. People came from Seattle. People with maybe a little bit more money lived in the Wing Point area. The Yomalt Cabin was built there by the WPA in 1933-34. Rolling Bay is another community. Donna Falk lived there, homesteaded. There's a Falk Road in the area. The Rodalls, they had a store and a post office in Rolling Bay. So there are a lot of different communities. Another one is Manitou Beach. The Morans built a school there, and Frank Moran happened to be a son of Robert Moran, who was the mayor of Seattle at one time, and a school for boys.
So was there awareness in let's say, Rolling Bay that there was a Linwood or a Seabold, or were they just kind of isolated, or did people come and go?
In the early days, they were pretty isolated. They were, like I was mentioned before, I didn't go to Seabold, which had their own store and so forth, unless you knew somebody there or had a reason to go there. They're pretty much isolated in their own communities.
Well, what was life like there?
Well, there was the ferry boat ran to Seattle from Eagle Harbor, and when you got on the ferry, you just about knew everybody on the ferry. People went to Seattle. They'd have to go to Seattle to buy school clothes, to buy anything but groceries, for instance. So it was an entirely different mode of living, right?
You talked about your area being largely Scandinavian, and clearly I'm guessing because of the various industries that people from other cultures came, and I had the sense, or my memory is from your tour, that there was a lot of sort of cultural diversity on the island.
There were, for instance, the Japanese who lived at the town called Yama in Port Blakely. When the mill closed in 1922, they spread out and bought land in different parts of the island to grow strawberries, and the land was pretty cheap. And so they spread out around the island, really, as far as buying this land. Some of them still lived in Winslow, like the Nakatas, who developed the grocery store that's there today. A lot of the land that they bought was very cheap. And of course, one of the ironic things is all the land had stumps because the trees were cut down. And that's why the land was so cheap, because it ended up being stumps. And of course, the Japanese had to have dynamite to get rid of the stumps. And when the FBI came to move the Japanese off the island, they discovered dynamite. And that was pretty bad, because they thought that they were going to use the dynamite on the people who lived on the island. That's why some of the men were put in jail when the war started, instead of being interned with the family, because these sorts of things happened.
So you obviously were here when that all happened. What was that like? What was the experience of that for you?
I was in grade school, 1936, started grade school, and a lot of my Japanese friends, this was over Pleasant Beach near Linwood Center, a lot of my friends were Japanese, and we went through grade six together, and all of a sudden, unbeknownst to us, that what was going on, they were all of a sudden missing, and we were not allowed to go down to see them off at the Ferry and Eagledale, the high school kids were, but we weren't. And all of a sudden they were not there. And so in those days, as a kid, 12 years old, they didn't tell us much. You know, we really didn't. And I think kids, too, really still have kind of a built-in thing that has them not worry about a lot of things that aren't necessary to worry about. And so that was an interesting part of the Japanese. Now, there were a lot of different communities. There were an area where there were a lot of Scots. There were a lot of English in Linwood Center. Emanuel Olsen was English. There was a Finnish area. There were some Hawaiians. There were Filipinos, because there were a lot of Filipinos on the island. And during the war, they helped keep care of some of the strawberry fields of the Japanese. And when the Japanese came back, they did some sharing of land. Now, everything wasn't perfect when they came back. A lot of the places were pretty run down. There were a number of Spanish, Italians, and like it said in the film, and a lot of Norwegians. So probably, I'd say the predominant culture or nationality was Scandinavian, but there were a lot of others, and people learned to live together. And
that there was that identity of those different kinds of communities then. And today, it strikes me as being pretty homogeneous. Were those people, the offspring of those people of different cultures, just became part of the community?
Just became part of the community. And it's people ask me today, of all the Japanese that were here, how many are there today? It's hard to say, because actually there are very few. Many of the older people have died off. They have died. The younger people have moved away, married, and so forth. So it's so different today with 26,000 people here, and so many commute to Seattle. They just moved here. There's so many new people in the last 10 years or so. That's a difficult thing.
And how does that feel to you, having grown up in a very small kind of intimate community and now having this large?
It doesn't bother me a bit. Where I live, in the same house I grew up in, and I say I've traveled a lot and been around, that I can sit there in this on my same property as I lived when I was a kid, and it's pretty much the same. If I want it to be the same, it is, right?
Are there many people like you who have basically, who were born here, are still around at an elderly age and live in the same general area, if not the same house?
There are probably, on my two hands, I might come up with 10 people, maybe 5 even, who still live in the area in the same place, more or less.
Wow. Yeah. Maybe we can invite some of those to take part in this kind of conversation, too.
I think so. Anyway, if I can say just a few words about the Japanese, when they came back, not much was said. In fact, at the museum, we made a film called After Silence, and kind of tells a story right there that there was about a period of 40 years where they were back here, and nobody said much, or nobody knew really what to say. It's just like when a friend of yours passes away, you meet the family, and what do I say? And so that's kind of the same with the Japanese people who came back. You're back. I remember when Norio Hirui walked into the class when I was a junior, came into a Spanish class and opened the door, and he comes in, and what do I say? I don't think I said, "Where have you been?" which would have been awfully stupid, but that was the way it was for about 40 years, and all of a sudden this uprising came of the internment, and we made the memorial wall, and it's nationwide knowledge today of the internment of the Japanese.
Well, it must have been just a remarkable experience to have lived through that, and then, yeah. What a fascinating story, just of him coming back and nobody really knowing.
Right, and another thing too, that the like those who didn't come back were friends of mine, and where did they go? Well, a few of them I've met in the last 10 years after some of them came back to Seattle, had no idea where they were, and so we've met up. A family, the Kitiyamas, who ran the greenhouses in Linwood Center, they developed one of the largest cut flower industries in the Bay Area in the United States. Wow. And have done very well. So,
well, this has been fascinating, and I can't thank you enough for coming by. And I've learned a lot in 20 minutes, and I'm sure our listeners have too. So.
Well, thanks. I hope that I've covered some parts that are interesting and informative, and we'll go from there.
Certainly interesting and informative to me. Thank you so much. It's really an honor to have you here.
Thank you, Jack.